to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry calls on China to urge North Korea to limit its nuclear program. The Zika virus becomes a topic of discussion at the White House. Our correspondent considers why Trump is walking away from a U.S. debate.
He's known for trying to control events, and it looks like this may be part of that in a way.
And a new film is creating a buzz at this year's Sundance Film Festival. It's coming up right here on The Voice of America. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held several hours of talks with his Chinese counterpart, Foreign Minister Wang Yi, with both diplomats saying they support a new U.N. Security Council resolution on North Korea's nuclear program. But Mr. Kerry called for significant new measures to punish Pyongyang for its fourth nuclear blast January 6. Mr. Wang cautioned a new resolution must not provoke new tensions or destabilize the Korean Peninsula. Mr. Kerry spoke at a joint news conference.
Kim Jong-un's actions are reckless and they are dangerous. Whether or not he achieved the explosion of a hydrogen weapon is not what makes the difference. It's that he is trying, that he wants to do that, and made the attempt against all of the international sanctions and resolutions that have been passed by the global community to prohibit that behavior.
Mr. Kerry noted that global sanctions helped bring Iran to the nuclear negotiating table. Mr. Wang pressed to do more to pressure its ally to give up its nuclear program, insists Beijing's position opposing it and seeking a diplomatic resolution has been clear-cut and responsible. The editor of the Asia-Pacific Current Events publication, The Diplomat, Ankit Panda, tells VOA's Victor Beatty he does not expect the talks to provide a high degree of success.
Overall, there is simply no common understanding between the United States and China on the right way to approach the North Korean issue, and nothing really changed with the nuclear test in that regard. The United States continues to insist that North Korea has to make some sort of bona fide gesture of denuclearization before it will consider returning to negotiations, and China continues to push for restraint and a return to the six-party talks process, which has been dead for about half a decade now. So it's really not a positive prognosis at this point.
Well, North Korea walked out of those talks, as I recall.
Absolutely, they did. Those fell apart, and they haven't come back together since. And Kim Jong-un obviously took over in 2011, and we've seen two nuclear tests under him with no sign of the North Korean nuclear program slowing down.
When news media write headlines like Kerry to urge China to put more pressure on North Korea, what does it mean? What could China do that it's not doing now?
Stopping oil exports, stopping civilian flights flying over its territory. But in general, the United States would be interested in seeing China apply strong UN sanctions against North Korea, which it is not willing to do, because Beijing holds the position that this problem is something that needs to be solved through diplomacy, through restraint, and it doesn't believe that punishing North Korea is the right path. And, you know, there is a degree of self-interest there for China. Refugees regularly cross the border into China from North Korea with great difficulty. And China worries that if the hammer of sanctions comes down even further, internal instability in North Korea could destabilize its border with the country. And that's obviously very negative for Beijing. So Beijing is happy to maintain a modicum of stability. Obviously, it's not happy with the nuclear test at all. China definitely does not support North Korea's continued nuclear developments, but it's also not keen to see economic difficulties in North Korea destabilize the country, potentially leading to a collapse of the regime or a potential refugee influx into China.
So if there's no progress made in forging some sort of common front between China and the United States vis-a-vis North Korea, where does the answer to responding to North Korea's latest nuclear test come from? Would it be the UN?
No, and that's actually the question that many policymakers and experts are wrangling with right now. There's really no consensus. And my sense, you know, talking to experts after North Korea's nuclear test, including experts with 20, 25 years of experience dealing with North Korea and the United States, is that essentially, we're at an impasse. There is the uncomfortable prospect that some people propose of acknowledging North Korea as a nuclear state and using that as the starting step to negotiations with North Korea, and essentially acknowledging that the policy conversation needs to shift from preventing North Korea from becoming a nuclear state to containing it as a nuclear state. And obviously, as you can imagine, that's politically very uncomfortable.
The state-run Xinhua news agency, in a commentary, said it was unrealistic to rely merely on China to press the DPRK to abandon its nuclear program, as long as the U.S. continues an antagonistic approach wrought by a Cold War mentality. Well, with a look at what's being said on social media is VOA's Michael Lippin, who joins me here at the anchor table. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Susan. While staying on the topic of North Korea, if you do a search for hashtag North Korea on Twitter, you'll find a new article published on Wednesday by the Washington Times newspaper. In that article, reporter Guy Taylor writes, Chinese officials say they will support a new UN resolution condemning North Korea's recent nuclear test, but they appear to be pushing back against the Obama administration's call for ramped-up sanctions against Pyongyang. Taylor also says it remains to be seen whether the Obama administration will succeed in convincing Chinese leaders to change their posture, or if Washington will settle for a new UN resolution that levels harsh rhetorical criticism toward Pyongyang without any economic punishment.
So, Michael, what's trending on Twitter today?
Well, you know, one topic that's in the top 10 list of trending items worldwide is Auschwitz. That is the former Nazi death camp in Poland. Well, Wednesday, January 27th, is the 71st anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz by Soviet troops toward the end of World War II. I mean, the United Nations General Assembly has designated January 27th as International Holocaust Remembrance Day. On this annual day of commemoration, the UN urges every member state to honor the victims of the Nazi era, mostly the 6 million Jews, but also members of other minority groups. The UN also encourages them to develop educational programs to help prevent future genocides. And if you search for Auschwitz on Twitter, you'll see many historical photos and images of Auschwitz. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. And we were talking earlier today on an earlier edition of International Edition how it's important for a day of remembrance, but also of a day of understanding and compassion.
That's right.
Okay,
thanks,
thank
Susan.
You, Michael.
Okay.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
A team of experts at North Carolina's Duke University are tweaking a simple new blood test they've developed that will allow medical professionals to determine whether a respiratory illness stems from a viral or bacterial infection. Bacterial infections are usually treated with antibiotics, which are ineffective against viral infections. The test will help doctors pinpoint the appropriate antibiotics to fight the infection if it's bacterial in nature and consider treatments other than antibiotics if caused by a virus. The scientists who are developing this blood test say they hope that it will help stem the trend of overprescribing antibiotics, which some say has led to an increase of antimicrobial resistant bacterial strains. One of the lead researchers, Dr. Ephraim Salik, said that about three-fourths of respiratory patients are prescribed antibiotics despite the fact that the majority actually have viral infections. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Transparency International, the Berlin-based anti-corruption group, has released its annual Global Perceptions Index of Official Graft. It shows that while most countries are perceived as highly corrupt, many improved the ratings in 2015. Finn Heinrich, the group's research director, says average citizens are taking action and speaking out against corruption, and in some cases, governments are responding.
A country like Senegal, which, you know, some years ago was not seen as a positive story on corruption, really has getting the basics right. So I think what you need is an engaged citizenry which demands accountability and change, and leaders which hear the call and take action.
Aren't many of these nations authoritarian and don't really listen to the will of the people?
Yes. I mean, if you look at the bottom of the index, you have basically two cases, right? You have one, countries which have governments which have lost control over their territory, which don't provide the basic services, failed states, basically, right? Libya, Yemen, and others. Or you have very authoritarian countries, as you say, who have, I would argue, too much control over their society, who don't allow citizens to hold them accountable, who don't care about citizens and their needs. And both those cases are very fertile soil for corruption.
The report mentions specifically, among other nations, Guatemala, Sri Lanka, and Ghana, where citizens are working to drive out corruption.
That's right. I mean, Guatemala is an interesting example because there really millions of people have demanded change at the highest echelons of power over the last year, and they have succeeded, supported by the international community, who set up an international court to prosecute corruption, and the president is now being prosecuted. And that was something which I think was unfathomable 2-3 years ago. So it takes both, you know, demand from the bottom and then support either from the top or international actors.
Brazil is rated as the biggest decliner in the index.
That's correct. Brazil is the biggest decliner. It has gone down by 5 points, which is indicates really corruption is getting worse. Major scandals are erupting corruption, as the prosecutor of the country himself acknowledges, is rife everywhere. And the government is not really doing enough to show that they are serious about cleaning up the act, particularly at the highest levels in ministries and the president being implicated herself.
Transparency is calling on people to take action by voting on a website.
Yeah, we listed 10 cases of what we call grand corruption, where really powerful people have diverted money, public money, to their own private interest. And people can come to the site unmaskthecorrupt.org and vote for the case which they think symbolizes the scourge of corruption most prominently.
That website is unmaskthecorrupt.org. Transparency's Index of Expert Opinions ranked the perceptions of public sector corruption in 168 countries. Denmark took the top again for the second year in a row, while North Korea and Somalia were found to be the worst performers. Top performers shared the characteristics of high levels of press freedom, access to budget information, high levels of integrity among those in power, courts that treat the rich and poor the same and are truly independent. The lowest-ranked countries shared a high level of conflict, poor governance, weak public institutions, and a lack of an independent media. Coming up on International Edition, a leading Republican contender steps back from the mic and a new film as people talking Oscars. U.S. President Barack Obama has called for the rapid development of tests, vaccines, and treatments for the Zika virus that has infected people in more than 20 countries and is a continuing problem. Joining us on the line is White House correspondent Aru Pandey, who's following this story. Welcome, Aru. Always nice to chat with you.
Thank you so much.
Hey, what are they saying over there at the White House about this new virus?
Well, on Tuesday, the president basically commissioned a meeting of his health and national security team to discuss the spread of Zika and the potential spread of Zika inside the United States. This is a concern, particularly because of the proximity. We're talking about the disease being prominent in South America and the Caribbean, and the World Health Organization has also said it's likely to spread across nearly all of the Americas. So on Tuesday, the president convened his key senior health advisors, the Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Matthews Burwell, the Center for Disease Control Director Dr. Thomas Frieden, and so on. And he basically, the president called on the need to accelerate research efforts and basically to make better diagnostic tests available, to develop vaccines, and basically ways to deal with this, and to basically ensure that all Americans have information about the Zika virus. As you know, authorities are asking Americans to be cautious, particularly pregnant women, in terms of traveling to the areas that are currently affected. So far, there haven't been any cases that have originated inside the United States. What we've seen are travelers who've come from other parts of the Americas and then being diagnosed with the Zika virus here in the U.S. But I think that's what the particular concern is, the potential spread of this. Obviously, it's a mosquito-borne virus. So the president wants to make sure that his key national health and security teams are on top of this, that he's being briefed on the number of cases, the potential spread here in the United States, but also on the potential economic and developmental impacts of Zika, not just here in the United States, but in all of North and South America and the Western Hemisphere.
Well, thank you very much, Aru, for filling us in from the White House.
All right. Thank you.
Donald Trump, the leading Republican contender in the 2016 U.S. presidential race, says he is boycotting the last candidate's debate before next week's first election contest in the state of Iowa. Trump, the billionaire real estate developer who has surged to the top in surveys of Republican voters, said he will skip Thursday's debate just 4 days before the Iowa party caucuses. I'm joined here in the studio by VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone. Welcome, Jim.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. Say, why is Trump backing out of this debate? He's not known for being a shrinking flower.
No, he's known for trying to control events, and it looks like this may be part of that in a way. He's had a long-running feud with one of the moderators who'll be on the debate, Megyn Kelly, a host on Fox News. They went toe-to-toe last August in the first Republican debate, if you'll recall. She asked some questions about comments he'd made about women, and he took great offense to that. He doesn't think he's going to be treated fairly, so he's already signaled to Fox he wasn't happy. They then put out a press release that was kind of tweaking of him, kind of snarky, sarcastic, and he used that to say, you know what, I'm just not going to show up.
Well, this is highly unusual for somebody to walk away from a situation like this.
It is. You have to wonder what the political strategy might be, though. The latest polls showed Trump surging in Iowa, still a very tight race with Texas Senator Ted Cruz. Could it be that Trump is looking to sit on his lead because candidates near the end of a vote don't necessarily want to take risks? And in a debate, we just don't know what could happen. And he was figuring certainly to go toe-to-toe to Cruz in the debate. That won't happen now. And for those who will be in the debate, do they attack Trump if he's not there? How does that make them look? So a lot of different political calculations are now being considered.
And we also have a fly in the ointment, the possibility that the also very wealthy former mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, may run as an independent. What's the stir on that?
Bloomberg has said he's interested, particularly if Trump is the Republican nominee and Bernie Sanders emerges as the Democratic nominee. He sees them both kind of on extreme wings of their parties, and he sees a path for someone to come out of the middle. The polls I saw on this saw not a great deal of support, though, for Bloomberg initially. First of all, there's a name identification question. How many people know who he is? He was only drawing 12 or 13% support in a race with those other two candidates. But we'll see. That would be sort of another monkey wrench in this whole thing. But you know what? By this point, we should be used to the unusual and unexpected happening in the 2016 race.
That's right. Thanks, Jim, for staying on top of it for us.
All right. You bet.
This is VOA.
Health news and notes. This is Living Better.
Office workers stream across a bridge into London. And come rain or shine, they're under increasing pressure to respond to emails all day long, says this man.
Just general day-to-day pressure to be available all the time, to answer emails all the time, to perhaps eat into people's leisure time and blur the boundaries between work and leisure.
Psychologists are concerned, especially about the pressure workers can bring on themselves. Dr. Richard McKinnon speaking via Skype.
Checking your email very early in the morning or checking in at late at night or leaving your email on all day. That has a much stronger relationship with email pressure. So it's not necessarily about how many emails we receive.
McKinnon says bad email habits are linked to higher levels of stress in office workers. In 2014, over 1 billion people worldwide were using mobile email. I'm Martin Seacrest for VOA's Living Better.
A new film that tells the story of Nat Turner, a slave who taught himself to read and then led a slave rebellion in 1831, has created a buzz at this year's Sundance Film Festival in Utah. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, The Birth of a Nation has people talking Oscars before it's even released to theaters.
Nate Parker took 7 years to write the screenplay for The Birth of a Nation. The film, in which Parker also stars and directs, tells the story of Nat Turner, a slave boy who learns to read and becomes a preacher in pre-Civil War Virginia. His masters hope that Turner's preaching will lead other slaves to be more subservient, so Nat is sent to other plantations to preach to the slaves. But his knowledge of the Bible and his exposure to the true misery of slavery soon lead Turner to encourage his fellow slaves to rebel against their masters. Nat Turner's rebellion left 60 slave owners and hundreds of slaves dead. Parker says that the film looks at the origins of issues that African Americans still have to deal with.
You know, my job as a filmmaker is to create content, to seek out material, to develop material that I think will help be progressive and deal with some of the systemic issues that we're dealing with. So to be able to write a project and then to go out and get it financed and attach talent and to go and shoot the movie and then to have Sundance recognize it and validate it and say this is something that we think is worth showing to the world and getting behind and sponsoring. I think that those are the steps that we need to take.
Armie Hammer, who plays Nat Turner's master Samuel, says that even though this is Parker's directorial debut, he ran the set like a seasoned veteran.
He showed up on the first day, and he wasn't shooting that day, but he showed up and he was in a suit. He had the tie on, and he walks, and he's like, put that camera over there, put this lens on it, bring me a viewfinder with this lens, move that light 6 feet this way, and then you two stand on your mark and get over there, and bring me those two things, and blah, blah, blah. And, he walked on the set with the confidence and skill and ability of someone who's directed 50 movies before.
The film comes at a time when Hollywood is wrestling with a lack of diversity in its Oscar nominations. Nate Parker says that the Oscar issue is just a symptom of a much wider problem.
I feel the injury every day that's happening in America, whether it be socially, Eric Garner, Oscar Grant, Trayvon Martin. I mean, there's just so many names. And I felt at some point, I have to live a legacy that addresses that for my children. So when my kids say, man, in 2016, there were a lot of things happening, Dad, like, what were you doing? I can say, you know what, I was addressing it with my talent, with my tool, using my ammo, which is film, to address issues that I felt needed attention.
Armie Hammer says that Parker's passion for the project carried the cast and crew through some very difficult times.
You could feel his passion bleeding out of him while we were doing this. Everybody else would be getting tired. Everybody else would be uncomfortable with the subject matter, which at some points in the film gets heavier, But he would be there unwavering, just the perfect leader for the project, really.
The film received several standing ovations at its premiere in Park City, Utah. Fox Searchlight Pictures has paid a record $17.5 million for the distribution rights. That's $7 million more than the previous Sundance record for Little Miss Sunshine. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Democracy is critical to Africa's future. But if democracy is to take root and flourish, specific conditions must be met. Chief among these are free and fair elections. These, in turn, cannot take place if the voting public lacks access to information about important issues, or if voters are prevented from meeting with or rallying for their chosen candidates. In other words, freedom of speech and of the press and freedom of association are indispensable aspects of free elections and of democracy itself. That is why the United States is concerned about the deteriorating electoral environment in Uganda and the run-up to the presidential and parliamentary elections set to be held on February 18th. 8 candidates are vying for the presidency, including sitting president Yoweri Museveni, who first came to power in 1986 but was only elected into office in 1996. He is currently running for a 5th term in office. According to Human Rights Watch, Uganda's current election campaign is fraught with intimidation of journalists, including threats or warnings of possible repercussions for critical reporting, government harassment and intimidation of independent voices in the media and civil society, obstruction and dispersal by police of opposition rallies with excessive illegal arrests, beatings, and other use of force by security personnel. At least one member of a candidate's staff, opposition campaign aide Christopher Aini, has disappeared. For the sake of Uganda and all of its people, the upcoming elections must be free, fair, and transparent. The United States believes that for this to happen, all Ugandans must have the opportunity to exercise their right to assemble peacefully, express their opinions, and participate in the electoral process free from intimidation and abuse. They also depend on government institutions and security forces remaining neutral, defending the rights of all people and protecting all parties equally, wrote State Department spokesperson John Kirby in a statement. We call on the government, civil society, and political parties to do their part to ensure a peaceful, transparent, and credible electoral process.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.